So about 3 weeks ago, we had a guest speaker, Ben Connolly, here from Minnesota Zen Center, and he gave a talk based on his book, Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara. And I thought I would try to speak a little bit about the Yogacara teachings. And this is kind of a different thing for me to do because my training mostly has been, well, in koan study and memorizing the sutras and studying the sutras that we do in service and zazen and following the precepts. And I haven't done until the last really 3 or 4 years started to sort of try and train in these teachings that are complex in words, but are not saying anything terribly complicated actually, but really take an awful lot of words to try and help us undo the sort of habits of mind. So I'm going to give it a try. Not talk about koans or anything. And I was thinking this experience for me is a little bit like how I've changed my perception of the solar system. I was thinking when I was little, I didn't think about it. And then there was an assumption that the ground was flat. I mean, it's pretty obvious. It appeared flat, it was flat. And then somewhere I must have learned that the earth was round. So that was like, whoa, that's interesting, it's actually round. But I probably still had the sense that the sun went from one side to the other, that the earth was the center of the universe. So I probably had that idea just in general that there's the earth, more or less static, and the sun's going around it. And then somewhere along the line at school, I would have got that flipped over. Like, oh, no, there's the sun, and the earth is going around the sun. That's starting to get more complicated. And I remember the images was, it was a sun that was just like the size of a tennis ball, and then the planets all in a neat line, all just going around the sun. Still pretty simple, kind of an image. And then I remember much later realizing, wow, the sun is huge, this enormous, enormous thing, and the earth is tiny, and a very, very long way back. And then the image of the solar system became far more complex, you know, like, wow, this is really not that simple diagram anymore. It's getting more complex or more subtle, really. Not more complex, more subtle. And then recently, I saw a diagram of that the sun is, you know, rushing through space, moving. So it's not this nice, neat thing where there's the sun and we're just going around like this. The sun is like zooming along and the earth is going around it like this. And all the other planets are spiraling around it in this very kind of complex pattern that's not even a linear pattern, it's curving. And so I feel a bit like my examination of the universe of my own mind is being a bit like that. You know, it's shifting from a static, fairly simple to understand, something understandable, to something more subtle and less understandable. So I also noticed that I felt slightly strange coming up here to talk, because I feel like I'm knowing less and less and less all the time. So what in the world could I say? So everything that I'm going to say, of course, is just like this model, and isn't it? You know, these are just models to help us undo the harmful habits, the harmful images that we have in our minds, to help us undo the harmful ones. And at least replace them with something more wholesome that will relieve people's suffering and our own suffering. So I'm going to talk about the storehouse consciousness and the eight consciousnesses, but mostly the eighth one, storehouse consciousness. So many of you are familiar with the six consciousnesses, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body and mind. The eyes see, the ears hear. The nose smells, the tongue tastes, the body feels, and the mind thinks. So they're the six that we have. Usually five in conventional sort of society, and in Buddhism we've got six. But actually we've got eight. So there's those six that I think all of us are pretty familiar with. And I like that mind and thinking is there, because I also think we have a bit of a tendency to think the objects are real and our thoughts are just our thoughts. But I'm noticing more and more how my thoughts translate into objects in the world. Like I had the thought, let's grow some vegetables, and now there's vegetables. You know, that began with this thought. So thoughts are, these are very powerful things, what goes on in our individual minds and in our collective mind. So I'm just going to read a little bit from Ben's book on the eight consciousnesses model. The Yogacara model for understanding consciousness. The purpose of this model is to help us see how we can let go of tendencies that lead to afflictive, painful, and difficult emotions and cultivate the capacity to manifest beneficial ones, emotions that are both pleasant to experience and conducive to kindness towards others. The Eight Consciousness Model is a Yogacara innovation that is an expansion of early Buddhism's teachings of the six consciousnesses, the ones that I just mentioned. So the seventh consciousness is manas. So manas is this idea that we exist. We have our thoughts, and then we are aware that we have the thoughts. That part of us that is aware that we have thoughts is called manas. And it's that capacity that humans seem to have somewhat more than a lot of other animals, but we don't know to what degree, but somewhat more. And that more is probably why we cause so much harm to each other. Because we have this idea that we exist specifically, and then we have this idea that you exist specifically, and we're going to talk about the storehouse consciousness, we dip into the storehouse consciousness, pull out a karmic idea about something, and then do something nice or do something not so nice. So manas, the way I sort of visualize it, I think of the six consciousnesses here, i.e. nose, tongue, body, mind. Then a bit like the face being manas, which kind of makes sense because we identify the face as us. This is me, neti, this idea that I exist. And then the storehouse consciousness is like this big body. So it actually looks like one of those, like a big fat laughing Buddha. Big fat body, which is a... This is just how I do it. It's not in the books anywhere. It's how I see it, as a big fat body of the storehouse consciousness. And what I want to talk about is what's in that storehouse, and can we change it? And the storehouse doesn't really exist, but just as a way to talk about it. So manas. The manas consciousness creates, this is from Ben's book, the manas consciousness creates the sense that there is a self that experiences objects. In meditation, as the storytelling mind relaxes and we settle into the coming and going of phenomena, the crying of gulls, the occasional sigh of the meditator next to us, the worrying about how soon the bell will ring, we often notice that there is a persistent aspect of mind that is a sense of experiencing things. In the early Buddhist teachings, one meditation adept called this the residual conceit, I am. I think that's very interesting, calling it the original conceit, that I am. Katagiri Roshi called it the observer and said this is one of the hardest things to let go of in meditation. This is manas, the sense that there is an I experiencing things. So that's the seventh consciousness. And then the eighth is the storehouse consciousness. The store consciousness is a way to describe the process by which karma ripens. The conditioning of our past is depicted as karmic seeds, and the way those manifest in our present moment experience as karmic fruit. And he gives this example. Have you ever been standing in the rain and seen one person shuffling along scowling at the clouds and another smiling and bouncing along in the downpour? The emotional reactions and conduct of the two people is the result of their karmic conditioning. Karma doesn't make rain. It makes smiles and frowns. It makes hugs and fists. And I was thinking that this is, you know, got a similar sound to Freud's unconscious, you know, and I think that there are some similarities and there's some differences. And in psychology, the focus, I think, is often on looking at what are the harmful things. Well, first of all, there's the sense that it's just an individual unconscious, like an individual storehouse. And I think it's more productive for us to think that a storehouse is much more permeable and permeating across everything. Like there's collective storehouse consciousness, cultural storehouse consciousness, much wider. But in conventional psychology, there's primarily the individual unconscious, and often the work is looking for what are the harmful thoughts that are there and how do we kind of get them out or how do we dissolve them. And that is a good thing. That's a good thing. But I think one of the things that's very nice about the storehouse consciousness way of viewing things, it's a lot about planting and watering good seeds. Because right here in the present, even if we've got a whole history, karmic history, of all sorts of things that have resulted in some negative thoughts and habits of mind of perceiving things in certain ways, so that we lose a little bit of curiosity, you know, something happens and we meet it with, oh, I know what that is, and we label it, we lose our curiosity. So we've got a whole karmic history of doing that. But all of that, even though all of that is there, in this present moment, we can plant a much more positive seed, and it's kind of pretty salient because we're doing it right now. You know, we do it right now. We can plant that seed. And one of the ones that has been my favorite that I've used over the years with myself and with other people is saying, the world is a better place with you in it. And this is a thought that I have about everything and everyone. Even though it can be tempting to think maybe not that person, but actually every person, everything, the fact that it's already here, the world is a better place with it there. It might need to be modified, might need to do something because that thing might be causing harm, you know, whether it's a person or whether it's plastic in the environment or whatever. But there's no need to hate it. There's no need to try and destroy it, this idea that the world is a better place with you in it. So that's an example of like a seed that we can plant. And I really like that one. You know, when I see people, I have that thought. When I see people, like, oh, it's so good that you're here, you know. It's not like, oh, you're kind of here. Maybe it'd be better if you weren't here. I try not to have thoughts like that. Just like, world is a better place with you in it. So that's an example of planting a seed. And particularly, I think, for many people, planting that seed for ourselves, like, it is better for the world that I am here. That's, I think a lot of people kind of have trouble with that thought. They kind of can think that when they're in a good mood, but maybe when something bad happens and someone's cross with them or they've made a mistake somehow and they're feeling bad about it, it might be a little hard at that point to go, the world is a better place with me here. So we can plant these seeds like hundreds of times a day. Plant them, water them. I also, another way I visualize this storehouse is like a big meadow or a field. So that, I use that image a lot. And I think I like it because you can have so much diversity in a field. And it's kind of also similar. Like you've got lots of different sorts of flowers, lots of different sorts of grasses, but they're one community. So it's another way to think of the storehouse consciousness. So when this is unexamined, we don't examine that meadow or that field, we don't know what's in the storehouse consciousness anyway. We can't really know. It's really, if you look at it, even for a little bit, you see how infinite it is. It's just infinite karmic interactions that have happened over space and time. we couldn't possibly even know it. It's sort of like unknowable. But if we don't examine it a little bit, then we might have some idea, a bit like the Earth's in the middle and the sun goes around. We might have an idea like that about ourselves, that we're in the middle. or that our thoughts are right, that we know best, that we know better than that other person. So if we don't examine this storehouse, it will just be filled with all sorts of habits and judgments and presumptions and prejudices. And, you know, a lot of them might be fairly neutral, some of them may be positive, but there's a reasonable chance that quite a few of them will be not so wholesome, just because we live in a world that's got a lot of unwholesomeness in it. A lot of wonderful things in it, but some unwholesomeness as well. So another way I think of manas, so you've got the six consciousnesses that are what are interfacing with our experience, that bring the experience in, and then manas sees something, dips, I think it's like eyes look down into the storehouse consciousness and then up and come to some conclusion. I like it, I don't like it, this is worth attending to, this is not worth attending to. And that this is not worth attending to, I think, is a really good one to look at, that we deeply, habitually don't see things, don't hear things, don't notice things, because there's so much stimulus in the world. And it's a nice practice to sort of extend what we pay attention to try and expand what we pay attention to and not just follow our normal habitual pattern of what we pay attention to. And another very useful seed to plant and water in the storehouse consciousness is that I cannot trust my own cognitions. I cannot trust my own perceptions, which turns out to be really quite a cheerful thing. It doesn't seem like it would be cheerful, but actually I think when we really don't, we realize that everything we think and say and do and perceive is provisional. All of it is just proximal. None of it is accurate. It doesn't mean that we're not like somewhere on the track, but that it can't possibly ever be accurate. I think it's very liberating, because then we don't have to worry about whether we're right. We don't have to worry about whether someone else is right or someone else is wrong, because we are all wrong. We're all wrong, but we can also be all wrong and trying to do our best to relieve suffering. So we're wrong, trying to do our best to relieve suffering. So I just wrote down here that when we really relax into knowing that we don't know anything, then we actually feel less threatened by the world, less aversive to the world, feel that things are more precious and things are more interesting. So Vasubandhu's Yogacara is 30 verses, and Ben goes through and comments. Each chapter is a comment on each verse. So I just wrote down one of the verses that I wanted to say something about, talking about the storehouse consciousness. It is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It is unobstructed and karmically neutral, like a river flowing. In enlightenment, it is overturned at its root. So the first part, it is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It is unobstructed and karmically neutral. It's like this, our unconscious, if you want to think of it just in psychological terms, or the storehouse consciousness, which is more pervasive, doesn't have any resistance to whatever we put in it. So it's not going to object if we put nasty thoughts there. It's not going to object if we put pleasant thoughts there. So the responsibility is really on us. There's no other adult who's going to say, hold on a second, that's not a good thought to have. It's only us that can do that. You know, we're planting the seeds, we're watering the seeds or not. Or we're watering harmful seeds, or we're watering beneficial seeds towards ourselves and towards others. We're the one doing it. The storehouse consciousness is just neutral. And I was thinking it's a little like the planet is like that too. The planet doesn't say, don't pollute me, or don't cut down my trees. It's just being itself and responds to the things that we do to it. So when we do positive things and we care for the earth and the soil and the atmosphere, the earth responds accordingly. And if we are harmful to it, it responds accordingly. But it doesn't resist what we're doing. It's neutral in that sense. It just is, and we're the ones that are acting upon it, sort of thing. So if we think of the storehouse consciousness a bit like that, it helps us to be kind of relaxedly vigilant to notice what we're doing, what we're putting in there, what habits of mind we're creating, what actions that we're doing, because each action has an effect that then also affects us and what we do next. So, and then the second part, like a river flowing in enlightenment, it is overturned at its root. I was really struck by this, the possibility. Like, actually, I think when I was reading this, I got this sense of what, when we use the word mirror, like mirror wisdom, I felt like I got more of a sense of it while I was reading this, that what about the possibility that this storehouse is so purified that it accurately mirrors back everything? That's all it does, is it effectively, accurately mirrors back everything that's unknowable, but the mirror just mirrors it back. Imagine what that would be like if this storehouse wasn't clouded by biases, if it didn't have any biases, and just when something comes into the six consciousnesses and Manas is just like really calmed down, there's just this pure mirroring back. I don't think it would be possible, really, probably, for any human to fully do that, but I think we could all do it a bit. We could all do it more. And Ben says a few things about this. A basic teaching of Buddhism tells us that we can let go of karma and find complete rest, nirvana. This third line says that in nirvana, the entire process of karma that occurs in the storehouse is overturned. There is a revolution at the root of consciousness, sometimes called a transformation at the base. It's very common in consciousness-only literature to speak of a revolution at the root, or consciousness, that makes the store consciousness into a great mirror wisdom that perfectly reflects without obscuration or coloration, a vast mind untainted by afflictive emotions, delusion, or conditioning. And then Ben, commenting about himself, says, though I'm still bound to this river of karma, I have confidence based in experience that you can begin to sense this mirror through practice. You can allow for the complete transformation of consciousness into something purely available to and manifesting what is, whose every action is made from the perspective of universal connection and infinite compassion. So that mirror-like wisdom of just meeting things with love and familiarity, not thinking of anything as alien or foreign, but meeting everything with love and familiarity, which doesn't mean it may not include occasionally sort of some firm action, but still with a sense of love and familiarity, and that this is me, that every other thing and every other being is me. It's an extension of the self, which is another way of talking about emptiness, which we've said before. So a little bit more on manas, this sense of self, this identification with a self. Manas, the consciousness that creates a self, is intimately related to our tendency to be dissatisfied. I think that's why, like, cats and dogs don't seem to suffer so much. I noticed that because, you know, I've got a dog, so I'm observing him a lot. He doesn't ever seem to think that he's lazy. I mean, I come home, I've been working, earning the money, doing all of that, and I come in, he's just like chilling. And he doesn't seem self-conscious about it at all. He's just totally fine with it. It gives rise to a focus on the self that results in confusion about the nature of what's happening in the moment, creating tendencies known as afflictions because they cause us to suffer. I think one of the reasons we feel a lot of confusion in the moment is that rather than just attending to what's happening, manas is having conversations with the storehouse consciousness about what am I going to do next? How do I relate to this? What should I do? And it's not paying attention, and then we get confused. And for me, and for many people, as expanding the concept of self really softens this, what is called manas here. Like, we can extend that I am Santa Cruz Zen Center. Like, my identity extends to this whole place, and it extends to Santa Cruz, and it extends to the human race, and it extends to sentient beings. The more I think in that way, then manas just becomes, I think, a lot less problematic, because when we expand out in a daily way, we expand our definition of ourself, then we are less likely to get confused, because we're less likely to contract into that identification with an individual self that we need to advocate for and protect and defend and so on. Because as soon as we contract around an individual self, by definition, we're assuming that the other thing out there is a separate thing. And therefore, we've set ourselves up now for a conflict of some sort. Just might be very subtle. So again, on manas, the verse 6, goes like this. Manas is always associated with four afflictions: self-view, self-delusion, self-pride, and self-love. And then I've just put notes to the side. Self-view is the view that there is a self. Self-delusion is confusion about what the self is, like thinking it's a separate thing. Self-pride is placing undue importance on oneself. And self-love is clinging to one's interest in a way that causes suffering. So it's not the sort of self-love about self-care, not that kind of, but wanting to, like, have pleasures for, clinging to pleasures for oneself. And I was reading about that, and then Ben said an interesting thing about food. So I want to read that out and tell you a little about my experience about that. Self-love is not about a healthy sense of self-esteem. Self-love is about clinging to what we want, clinging to life, and also pushing away what we don't like. Often, afflicted by self-love, we eat just what we want to get pleasure for ourselves. But it is possible to eat food not because you want it, or it's your favorite kind, but because you realize you have the capacity to be of service to others, and you can't do it without food. During formal meals on Zen retreats, we chant, "We regard this food as medicine to sustain our life. For the sake of enlightenment, we now receive this food." It is possible and quite wonderful to eat without self-love, to eat with love for everything. So I read this book while I was in Australia. I was in Australia for 2 weeks. I read 5 books while I was in Australia. It's amazing. I was looking after a one-month-old baby, my new grandson, and a two-and-a-half-year-old. And so I was just sort of housebound for 10 days, and I just got to read a whole lot of books. It was great. So I read this book, and I gave myself this, I had this idea, what if I said to myself while I'm here in Australia, every time I go to eat something and just say this in a joyful way, will eating this be of service to others? So that was the sentence that I gave. Will eating this be of service to others? And it was very interesting. I got to see how some of the food I eat is just because I feel like eating it. I'm not hungry. I don't need it. I just like it. So it's like, oh, this is very interesting. So then when I honestly go, will eating this brownie be of service to others? No. Not really. So I set that up for myself as a rule, then you don't eat it if it's not of service to others. So it's very good. I'm continuing to do it back here. We'll see if it lasts or whether it fades. But that's an example, another example of like planting this interesting seed. This is an interesting thought. Is what I'm doing of service to others to you know, contemplate that thought and water that thought. So I've actually lost 3 pounds just from that thought. Isn't that interesting? Like, not from dieting, but from that thought. Will this be of service to others? No. All right, don't have it. Or like, no, yes, this will be good for you to have this. This will give you the energy to get through the rest of your day. That's a good idea. What?
I said it's hard to know if brownies do that or not.
There'll be times, I'm sure, when brownies really do that. I mean, they're exactly the right thing to have. Like cookies after our talk.
Yes.
Absolutely, there's a great benefit to people to eat cookies after the talk.
They benefit the cookie bakers.
They do.
Yes.
By giving them merit.
That's right. And they create a focal point for conversation. They encourage more people to go to the talk. Like, will I go to the talk? Well, they do have cookies. So, of course, with all of these things, I think we should take all the teachings with a joyful disposition towards them. It's really not ever about, or not a good idea to do that. It's more like, is it a good idea to do that or not? Just a curious, just a curious attention. Okay. So another thing that Ben brings up near the end of the book is he uses the word projection, which is from what we've been talking about. Manas goes down to the storehouse consciousness, and with that karmic tendencies from there, translates the experiences that come in through the other senses and projects things onto the world, the unknowable world. So I'm just going to read a bit of what he says here. Thus, everything is projection only. Everything, our ideas, our feelings, what we see and hear, the sound of the breeze in the trees, the memory of a long-loved cat, the strum of hunger in the belly, our righteous rage, and our vast compassion, it's all projection only. Projection only is a translation of the term Vijnapti Matra. The famous school of thought associated with this text is called consciousness only, Chitta Matra, and I can see why. Projection only does not have the same ring to it. But Vasubandhu never uses Chitta Matra in this text, only Vijnapti Matra. Vasubandhu is precise and careful. He avoids the term consciousness only because he knows people might get confused and think he means the universe is made of consciousness or some such unknowable thing. He is saying instead that consciousness is all we can experience and that it is constructed by the habits of conceptualization in that process of consciousness itself. In short, all we really know is that we are seeing projection, projection only. And so that fits with that earlier comment that everything that we do and see is a mistake. You know, everything is inaccurate, but we proceed anyway. And whether what what actually exists in the kind of physical world, we don't know. Nobody knows. But we do know that we experience things and we project things onto the world. And I think if we can really settle into at least that part of it, don't need to worry too much about what actually is out there, if there's anything out there, but we do have control or some say over how we engage with it and whether we are motivated by a connectedness with all things and a desire to relieve suffering. So I also wanted to read just a couple of things and then we can go to comments and questions from Tenshin Roshi's book, The Third Turning of the Wheel, which a number of us are studying on Tuesday mornings. And there was a couple of things from yesterday morning's discussion that I wanted to read out about this ungraspable quality. These teachings show us that everything is basically a mystery, an ungraspable, inconceivable, inexhaustible mystery, until we start dreaming and superimposing our dream on the mystery. I'm a mystery, you are a mystery, people are a mystery. It is actually very helpful in our daily life to remember that people are a mystery, to remember that people are always beyond what we think they are. The same is true of all the activities and objects we encounter. I think that particularly that thing that people are always beyond what we think they are. I get trapped in that all the time and I have to correct myself. Like, oh, okay, I've got this opinion about this person. It is wrong. It's not like probably wrong. It is wrong. But now what do I do? What do I do next? And I still have to work out whether to do or say something or not, but I am definitely wrong. But so we should endeavor to keep that in our consciousness as much as possible, that whatever we think about other people, they are far more than what our minds can imagine them to be. And then one other thing from Tenshin Roshi. If you sit in a chair without any expectation of what would happen, so this is again about being not putting your preconceived notion of something onto something. If you sat in a chair without any expectation of what would happen, you would be studying the mystery. Maybe the chair will support you and maybe it won't. In studying the other dependent character, you're ready for the chair to collapse or fly through the air or even support you. You're ready for everything, including the unknown. When you sit in chairs like this or meet people like this, you don't get burned out. But when you meet people according to your idea of them or you sit in a chair according to your idea of it, that will burn you out. Whatever idea you have of people or chairs, you must give it up. Then what could you do with the chair? You could study it. You could wonder about it. And we were commenting yesterday that joyfulness that you see in children might be partly because they keep meeting things freshly over and over and over. You know, they meet something like, oh, look at this thing. And we can be more like that. You know, when we see a chair, we can go, oh, look at that chair, and just be interested in it rather than having a sort of a jaded, blurred, sort of just imputation chair. You can see how life could be not so enjoyable if we just did that a lot, and how much more enjoyable if we were fresh with each thing, you know, fresh, each person, each object. Okay, I think that's all I've got to say. Would anyone like to comment or ask a question?
When you are tuning in your food practice, and you're mm-hmm. tuning in to, your question is this going to be a benefit to all beings?
Yeah.
Where do you go to ascertain your response? I mean, how do you mm. know? Is it just a gut feeling, or I'm curious about how, yeah. like why sometimes would the brownie be helping all beings and not?
Yeah. Well, I guess that's part of, like, why we're all muddling along, because we don't really know. Like, sometimes I might ask that question and think, this will be helpful to others, but actually it's just because I really want to have another hot chocolate or something. I don't know. I guess we just ask and notice.
Just notice
what comes up next. Yeah. Like, I feel like this must be being good because I do have this feeling, not that I've got any real problems with the size of my body, but I do think that I don't particularly need to be carrying a certain amount of weight on these thighs. It's not really helping anyone. It's not really, and it probably is going to make it harder for me to get up on the tarn in these robes, you know, so that probably isn't especially helping people. So that would be when I've had enough calories and then I feel like having something because I'm tired, because that's what happens to me. I work, do a lot of cerebral work, my head gets tired, but my body doesn't need anything, but my head gets tired. And I want to have something to try and gain some energy. But if I ask that question, that might help me intercept a deep habitual karmic tendency from the past to do that and go like, no, I'll make some ginger tea instead. Something like that.
Interesting.
Patrick.
We all really enjoyed meeting Ben Connolly 3 weeks ago, but we also really enjoyed going to your ordination 4 weeks ago. And so many, many congratulations. When you were in Australia before taking care of your grandkids versus when you were there, you know, a week ago taking care of your grandkids, what's that Dharma gate that you've gone through being ordained and doing work or taking care of your grandkids or taking care of Prana?
Yeah, I've been wondering, do I feel different? What's, having been ordained? I think I don't know yet. I think it's going to kind of subtly unfold. At the moment, I'm dealing just with sort of the practical aspects of putting on robes and things, just dealing with that. Just kind of nice. It feels like a nice balance between the ceremony, which is like this beautiful, wonderful ceremony, and then just the humble practice of trying to get robes on right and things like that. But I suspect it will be very beneficial. I can say that. Yara.
As I was driving to work this morning and heard an interview with a man that had been a serious addict, drug addict. He's now not an addict and hasn't been an addict for a while. But he talks about how when he was in his addiction, he was only kind of, I mean, these are me putting words based on what you just said. He was kind of only having thoughts of just negativity and all the things he wouldn't be able to do, and just, it was just all kind of negative. And now looking back, he goes, I couldn't even imagine sort of a life outside of that, and yet here I have it. And I had only kind of negative viewpoints of addiction myself. And he said what really made the difference, because it took him a while to get to the point of kind of quitting, was someone just very starkly kind of mirroring in a sort of tough sort of way, either you need to get a grip here and do something, or because I don't want to see you die in my house. It was his mother that did this for him. And so it just kind of got him out of all of his, kind of like, I'm a bad person, and therefore let's do more drugs. And then he said what was really a really critical thing for him when he finally did go to this one particular rehab was that he said he met someone that had said to him, 5 years ago, I was exactly in the same place that you are now. And for him to see this other person, a positive image of someone who had gotten sort of to the other side of it, enabled him to imagine and kind of, you know, plant some other seeds of like, wow, actually, there's some kind of possibility here. If this person could be as addicted as I was, but here he is now, the head of his program, and talking to me, that there's something else. So it just, it sort of reminded me of that kind of planting some other seeds. And then he was in a circumstance where he could, you know, he said there's a lot of educational stuff about drugs, and that just because you had an addiction, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to be addicted the rest of your life. So, kind of unrelated, but it just sort of reminds me of that whole, the storehouse. Like, if your storehouse, you're just putting in, you know, depression, too, if you're just constantly putting in all these negative thoughts about yourself and how you can never do this, and you don't like that, and, you know, this is the way it's always going to be. That's kind of, it's this self-fulfilling kind of prophecy, right?
Two things that come up for me hearing you speak about that is the mother saying what she said. That's a little bit like an example of like an accurate mirroring that she did. She was able to overcome whatever, I mean, I don't know the story, but let's just say, overcome a sense of herself that she should be one way or another way, and she was able, with love, to be able to be quite clear with someone and give them this incredible gift by helping them stay, see something they couldn't see. So that mirror wisdom doesn't have to be always very gentle and quiet. Sometimes that mirror wisdom can be quite forthright. So that's that seems like an example of that. And then the other thing that came up for me as you were talking is how important it is for all of us to be good models out there in the world, because people are walking around trying to figure out how to be, and they look to other people around them. And if they see people being kind and decent and calm and steady, they might think, oh, maybe I could be a little bit like that. I mean, I think a lot of us have had that experience, you know, with Zen teachers and with other practitioners. We look at them, we watch them, I want to be a bit more like that. I do that a lot. Yeah, thank you. We need to finish. Yep, last one.
I just appreciate so much how you keep joyfully interacting with the world, and both you genuinely know the suffering enough to know that you want to alleviate it, but you do have this beautiful childlike joy of like, well, let's just keep figuring this out.
Oh,
thank
you. Thank you. Yes. Otherwise we would burn out.
Yes.
That's right. We have to keep curious and childlike. All right. Well, thank you. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The delusions are inexhaustible.